I think the time has come. Well, my role is a very simple one, and I'm going to be very short, because all I'm going to do is introduce not just today's event, but the series of events that are going to be held here under the auspices of the title Creating a Sustainable Society. So tonight we're talking about empires of the 21st century, and then on the 3rd of March we're going to have 4 speakers on the theme of rebuilding local economies, and then on the 19th of March we're going to have the future of global governance. So don't just come, if you don't mind, don't just come to today's event, but see it as a series that is meant to provide quite a comprehensive picture of many aspects of how to deal with globalization, or perhaps you can at this moment in time say the Americanization of the world. And as you can see on your leaflets, today's event is organized by a coalition of groups, the Earth Emergency Group, which came together before the Earth Summit in Johannesburg, trying to define the key issues of what a sustainable world could be or should be in the face of the onslaught of globalization on the planet. Then we have the Schumacher Society, of which I'm the chairman, not named after a racing driver, but after somebody who died 30 years ago and who wrote a book called Small is Beautiful. We have Positive News, a wonderful magazine which comes out about 4 times a year, dealing, as the title says, basically with how we can make a better world rather than always responding to negative news around the planet. And then we have LSE Attack, concerned again primarily with issues of globalization. And then we have Le Monde Diplomatique, represented by 2 speakers tonight. So we have a very interesting and full program this evening. Yes, I'm just being asked, can you please turn off your mobile phones? But before I do anything else, I would like to introduce one person to you who actually organized these events simply because she has a passion and a love for the world and wants to make it a better place, Francesca Giordano, who does this without funding simply because she feels that we need to have a new vigor and determination in our discussion. So it's wonderful. Please stand up, Francesca. For doing this for us, and of course nobody's been charged a penny to be here tonight, so if you can make a little bit of a donation towards the costs of her time and her the need to keep her going financially, that would be wonderful. But I would now like to hand over to Mary Caldor, who is going to chair the event tonight, and it's wonderful that you've taken on this role. Mary is a professor for international relations here at the university, and wonderful that you're here. So thank you very much for coming, everybody, and I'm looking forward to a very exciting and interesting evening.
Well, I was also very pleased to be invited to chair this debate because I really feel quite strongly that it's very important that LSE students in particular, but the public in general, get more politically engaged in these globalization issues. I think we're at a very, very crucial moment in history where debate, discussion, deliberation is all we have as a method of opposing some of the very frightening developments that I think might unfold in the next few weeks. I understand, and one of the key things about this meeting is that it was organized to launch the new edition of Le Monde Diplomatique in English. And so I think that's a very, very good development. As someone who's been reading Le Monde Diplomatique for many years, I highly commend it as an articulate, committed, and serious journal. And I hope it will become, in a way, I mean, it already is, in a way, the voice of all those people who are active in the social fora and other kinds of related movements.
And it is in English.
And it's, did I not say it was in English? I thought I did. It used to come out in English in the Guardian.
Yes, that's right.
But it's very nice that it has its own edition now. And you can look up its website. So without any more ado, this is an important subject, empires. And we have three speakers, although our third speaker has not yet arrived. But our first speaker is Philip Golub, who's a contributing editor of Le Monde Diplomatique, and he's going to talk very appropriately about the American Empire.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Mary. I indeed am going to talk in the very brief time that we are allotted about the century-long cycle of American Empire, which began at the end of the 19th century and culminated in 1991 with the rise of American unipolarity and has now become fully apparent in the choice made by the Bush administration to exercise American global governance, if that's the appropriate word in this case, through the exclusive use of force in the international system, foregoing all other methods and techniques of international regulation, in particular interstate cooperation. There's been a very curious and important ideological change which has occurred in the United States over the past couple of years. An ideological change which was aggravated after 9/11. And I'm not referring to the fact that the American people or that the American political elites now feel more vulnerable because their vulnerability was demonstrated by 9/11, nor the idea widely discussed and spread that the United States has again lost its innocence in 9/11, and suddenly today is coming to grips with a Hobbesian and violent world. I'm talking about the fact that in the United States over the past couple of years, even prior to 9/11, we have been seeing the reemergence, more precisely, of an explicit imperialist discourse and an explicit imperialist ideology. In fact, the American foreign policy elites, if you take the time to read the American press and American publications, which demands quite an effort, of course, and I'm not asking you to all go through American publications of the past 2 years. You have enough to do with the British press and British publications. But if you do spend a bit of time scouring through American specialized publications in the American media, you'll realize that empire is back in vogue and that the word empire has become a part of the American political vernacular. There are, in fact, two major ideological camps, I would say, which have appropriated imperialism as their new outlook and have made imperialism quite explicitly their new outlook. And this is something that you here in the UK should relate to, because if you look at the past history, Britain's past imperial history, you will find that the similar kinds of ideological divisions and camps existed in Great Britain in the 19th century. On the one hand, you have what I would call a liberal imperialist camp in the American foreign policy elites, which feels residually guilty about, and a sense of contradiction, moral contradiction, about the fact that they have become overt imperialists, because I think it's somehow in contradiction with the democratic ethic which founds American society and the American political system, but which nonetheless argues today that the United States, that the world has imposed on the United States, has thrust upon the United States an inevitable role as imperial regulator. Okay. Mostly, the advocates of the liberal imperialist camp argue that the United States is either an accidental empire, or that George Bush has become an accidental imperialist, and I will give you some quotes to demonstrate what I'm saying, or alternately, that the United States is a reluctant empire, a hesitant empire, which somehow is being forced to take on the white man's burden and the task of global ordering. Okay, to give you some examples, Sebastian Mallaby, who's an editorial page writer of the Washington Post and who's a quite prominent foreign policy commentator in the United States, published an article in Foreign Affairs not so long ago. Foreign Affairs is the most prominent American foreign policy publication based in New York. So Sebastian Mallaby published an article in Foreign Affairs in April 2002 entitled The Reluctant Imperialist, Terrorism, Failed States, and the Case for American Empire. In that article, he argued, after having drawn a totally apocalyptic vision of failed states, uncontrolled population growth, endemic violence, and social decay in significant parts of the third world, after drawing that apocalyptic picture, he argues that the United States has no choice but to become the imperial and imperialist regulator of the world order. I quote him, "Non-imperialist options such as foreign aid and nation building are not reliable answers at the present time. Today, the logic of neo-imperialism is too compelling to resist." Likewise, a fellow commentator of his in the Washington Post, mind you, the Washington Post, you know, used to be known as the newspaper which published the Pentagon Papers and was, you know, towards the late 1960s became antagonistic to the war in Vietnam. It was used to be considered a liberal paper, okay? No longer today. Likewise, Jackson Deal, who's another editorial page writer in the Washington Post, published a more recent apology of empire entitled The Accidental Imperialist, in which he characterizes George Bush's response to the events of 9/11 as an inevitable effort by the United States to restore world order. But the most articulate version of the liberal imperialist view and thesis was penned by Michael Ignatieff of the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University, recently in the New York Times Magazine, and who makes a quite strong case, actually, as far as the argument goes, makes a quite strong case for an American imperial role. And he argues that the United States may not, cannot survive in safety, I'm quoting him, all right, may not survive in safety at home without imperial policing abroad. So that American safety now depends on empire, in other words. American safety, like British safety in the 19th century, the safety of the Indian Empire, the Indian part of empire in the 19th century, depended on the permanent extension of the British Empire. Likewise today, American society cannot survive, in his argument, without the extension of American power abroad. And he goes on to argue, and I think it's worthwhile quoting him at some length, "America's empire is not like empires of times past, built on colonies, conquest, and the white man's burden. We are no longer in the era of the United Fruit Company, when American corporations needed the Marines to secure their investments abroad. The 21st century imperium is a new invention in the annals of political science, an empire light, a global hegemony whose grace notes are free markets, human rights, and democracy, enforced by the most awesome military power the world has ever known." And he goes on and on and on. These liberal imperialists, as I indicated, you know, there's a certain hesitation on their side because they think somehow that there might be, there possibly could be a contradiction between their advocacy of policing the world on the one hand and on the other hand, American democratic and liberal values. The idea that the awesome military power can somehow be brought into harmony with free trade and liberal democratic values is a purely hypothetical construct, which I think is being contradicted at the present time. And then, besides the liberal imperialists, you have a camp of hardcore right-wing radical imperialists, okay? Right-wing ideologues from the neoconservative camp, in particular in the United States, who feel entirely comfortable with the idea. They feel no moral ambiguity at all over the idea that the United States, that American empire, is not only a good thing, but it's a great thing for the world. It's a benevolent empire. It is a gracious empire. It is a necessary empire. To give you some examples of this, Charles Krauthammer, who is one of them, he's another Washington Post editorial writer, he's a major neoconservative voice in the United States, wrote a couple of years ago, he wrote this in 1999, that no country has been as dominant culturally, economically, technically, and militarily in the history of the world, including Rome. He adds to that in his article that this is, of course, a good thing. He's prescriptive. This is not merely descriptive, but prescriptive, okay? It's part of the construction of an imperial ideology. Max Boot of the Wall Street Journal, has likewise stated in an article entitled The Case for American Empire that it is, and I'm quoting him, it is striking and no coincidence that America now faces the prospect for military action in many of the same lands where generations of British colonial soldiers went on campaign, places where Western armies had to quell disorder. Now, this is remarkable stuff. This may not be remarkable. This may not be new to many of the third world peoples on the receiving end of Western and American power over the past 3 or 4 or 5 or 8 decades. But it is remarkable stuff in terms of American political discourse and in terms of the way in which America's foreign policy elites actually see themselves. This is we're actually witnessing a major ideological transformation. And in this major ideological transformation, we are seeing the assertion, not merely the recognition, but the assertion that the United States has become an imperial power. In fact, we have not seen any discourse of this kind in the United States since the late 19th century. And the first time since the late 19th century that we're seeing an upsurge of this kind in all of the specialized journals and the press. Why the late 19th century? Because in the late 19th century, as you all certainly know, the United States thrust itself on the world stage, all right? It began in the late 19th century, from 1895 to 1898, its process of global expansion in the Pacific, the Caribbean, and Asia, okay? The Philippines, Cuba, and the Pacific Islands. The United States at the time, if you look at the text, this has been documented in dozens and dozens, if not hundreds of books on American open-door diplomacy, economic diplomacy, but also in books on American political ideology at the end of the 19th century. At the time, the United States was seized, America's political elites were seized by an astonishing, a prodigious imperialist kind of, you know, discourse, a fervor, an imperialist fervor. At the time, just like today, at the time, there were journalists, American journalists, for example, from the Louisville Courier Press, which is like a kind of local newspaper, all right, comparing the United States to Rome at its height, and even saying that the United States is destined, a journalist called Henry Morris Watterson, who wrote at the time that the United States is destined, this was premonitory, okay, is destined to define, I'm paraphrasing, to define and shape the world in ways greater than all empires ever did in the past, greater even than the Roman Empire ever did, you see? And there are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of quotes of this kind from the late 19th century. And we're seeing this again today. What we're seeing today is a revival of the kind of imperialist fervor that was seen in the late 19th century. And this is of course, not coincidental, because in both cases, what we are witnessing are moments of expansion. The late 19th century was the first phase of American expansion on the world stage. And what we are seeing today is what I would consider the final phase, the culminating phase, okay, of a century-long process of construction of American empire. If you look at the United States today, the United States is spreading under Bush. I shouldn't say the United States. I should say the Bush administration, okay? The Bush administration, which has seized control of the United States accidentally, thanks to the Supreme Court, the Bush administration is spreading American power and American control over areas which the United States in the past was not present in, okay? The United States has added 15 new military bases to its archipelago of military bases which already exist in the world. The United States today has 160 military bases girdling the world, you see, from Latin America through the Mediterranean and Central Asia, and the Middle East, of course, all the way to East Asia. The United States has moved into Central Asia in a very big way. We're seeing a process of expansion and formalization of America's military empire. And at the same time, we are seeing a reliance upon the use of force as the defining characteristic, as the defining characteristic of American foreign policy, hence of global policy. Because the United States is not only the center of global capitalism since 1922, 1923, but the United States is, of course, today the only major power. It is a unipolar power, a de facto unipolar power. Okay. The war against Iraq will be, in effect, the modern-day variant, the contemporary variant, of the war against Spain, which led to America's first imperial expansion. Okay. So I say the culminating phase of American empire, what do I mean by that? I mean, there were three phases. I'm simplifying, of course, but there were three major phases of construction of empire. The first phase was from the 1860s to 1917, or in fact till 1922, when the United States overtook Great Britain as the world's leading manufacturing power, and then in 1922 as the center of global capital flows. There was the second phase, post-1945, when the United States emerged as the Western world's major political power, and where its political power and economic power became synchronous, okay? And the United States post-1945, from 1945 to 1991, managed the world system, the Western world system, in semi-cooperative, semi-coercive manner, all right? Which is the classic definition of hegemonic practice. And then 1991, which marks a major break in historical terms because the United States became the single and only great power. And this, of course, unipolarity is a singularity in modern history. Unipolarity is a singularity in the sense that there's no power in modern history since 1500. In fact, there's probably no power ever in world history, not even Rome. And in that sense, some of the neoconservatives are right descriptively, all right, that has had a monopoly on the use of force in interstate relations like the United States wields today. Great Britain in the 19th century did not wield that force, did not have that force. Great Britain was faced with competitive powers, France, Germany, and so on and so forth. And if you look at the size of the British Imperial Army, the size of the British Imperial Army in 1860, you will notice immediately that essentially their regulation of the system, of the Western capitalist system, of which they were the center, was not primarily based on force in their relations to other Western powers. It was based on force merely, and it was terrible, of course, in their relation to the colonial era. In any case, to make a very long story short, the United States, unlike Great Britain in the 19th century, unlike Rome, because, you know, besides Rome there was China, and besides China there was Persia, and so on and so forth, the United States today faces no grand strategic rival in military strategic terms. And its main economic competitors were, until a couple of weeks ago, strategic allies inserted in the American global political economy, okay? That's changing now. I mean, it might be changing in any case if France pursued and Germany pursued their policy. Unipolarity created the structural conditions for empire. Unipolarity created the structural possibilities for empire. But the project of empire, which is something quite different, the project of empire is a project which the American New Right, the American conservative right, is now pursuing with the aim and the intent to maintain unipolarity well into the 21st century and to advance America's strategic positions globally. If you read their text, they say so quite clearly. Mortimer Zuckerman, others say, we have 20 years ahead of us to consolidate unipolarity and to ensure that the world system will remain, that the status quo which emerged after 1991 will be stabilized in favor of American power. That is to say, they want to use this exceptional moment in world history where the United States has a monopoly on the use of legitimate violence in the international system to consolidate and extend the frontiers of American hegemony. And the real question now is, I'm being very synthetic, and I can't back up my argument, okay, in any kind of scientific way here. But what it breaks down to is this. Ultimately, is this sustainable? Okay. Are we in the middle phase, the middle mature phase of construction of American empire? Or are we at the end declining phase of American empire? And I would like to make my concluding remarks on this point. All mature imperial powers, historically speaking, and I hope no one here is going to contradict me, all mature imperial powers, previous imperial powers, during their mature phase, during their ascendant phase, okay, and their phase of consolidation, based themselves on some form of institutionalized cooperation. Great Britain in 1860 with its European partners, and so on and so forth. Okay. There's a large amount of empirical historical evidence to that effect. And that only in the late phases of beginning decline do they come to rely on force and force alone. Of course, to construct empire, they also use force, colonial empire. But also in their declining phase, they become militaristic. Okay. This is a general trend. Today, the United States, which won World War I and World War II and World War III, the Cold War, to its advantage, okay? The United States has entered into a period where it has chosen, its foreign policy elites have chosen, to remilitarize massively and to use that remilitarization effort as the central focus of American global governance. Within 5 years, the American military budget will equal or surpass the military budgets of all the countries of the rest of the world combined. Today, the American military budget is equivalent to the military budgets of the 25 next biggest defense spenders. Within 5 years, the United States will outspend the entire rest of the world. Is this sustainable? In the short run, yes. At 3% of GDP today, 5% of GDP at the end of the mobilization, it's probably sustainable in some ways. But America has structural vulnerabilities. It's foreign debt. It's growing internal debt. Its position in the international political economy, which is based on complex relationships of dependence and interdependence with Europe and Japan, among other countries. Moreover, the United States is today, the Bush administration is destroying the framework, the institutionalized frameworks, the frameworks of institutionalized cooperation, which it itself created in post-1944. The United States right now is in the process of destroying the United Nations, is in the process of weakening the multilateral institutions and the credibility of the international institutional system. It is generating fear, angst, and awe throughout the world, okay? There's only so long you can govern that way. There's only so long you can govern the world that way. And to conclude, I would say this. In The Prince, Machiavelli quite rightly points out that the prince who wants to last, that lasting power, he didn't quite use these terms, okay? But that long-term lasting power depends on making your subjects happy. He actually says that, depends on making your subjects happy. From 1945 to 1991, the United States made some of its subjects happy. Look at its relationship to Germany and Japan. Look at its relationship to Italy, to the UK. Didn't make all of them happy, but made some of them happy. And the weaker parts of the world system, the weaker states in the world system, actually, the European states, in the triad, in the core, actually benefited from American hegemony and predominance to some extent. They benefited economically in any case. Today, the United States is not making its subjects happy. That, therefore, I think that we are in the end phase, the culminating phase, a very dangerous culminating phase of American empire. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Philip, and I certainly agree very much with your last point. I suspect this might be far from the beginning of a new phase of empire, the culminating, but as you say, very dangerous moment. I'm going to take two questions before I ask Robert to speak. So who would like to ask Philip a question? There's a gentleman in the back there.
Hi, yes. Is this working?
Yeah.
Okay. I'm interested in specifically a rendition of Empire, although I kind of want to add that Machiavelli also said that it is safer to be feared than loved, so maybe add that. I'm wondering exactly if in framing the conditions of possibility for future politics, if we do that in terms of empire, where does that take us and how do we respond to it? I mean, whether it's liberals who are speaking about empire, and it's very interesting that Ignatieff writes about empire, saying he's Canadian, he's not American. Although he works, and I mean, he spent a lot of time in the U.S., but it's very interesting, when I've heard him speak in Canada, it's coming, it's very unique that he's talking about empire. I mean, it's twisted, right? And the krauthammers and so on and so forth. But we also have people on the far, far left, Hart and Negri, who write about empire, and others. And I'm concerned that, to a certain degree, we're severely restricting any possibilities for responding to empire because we continuously rephrase the problem in terms of empire. Which means some sort of hegemonic discourse, some sort of global overpowering of something. And I don't see exactly where that gets us. So I'm curious how you would respond to that.
Well, I didn't invent their discourse on empire. And Tony Negri's and Hart's book deals with, is a slightly different conception of empire, actually. I start from the presupposition that while capitalism, of course, evidences a global dynamic, that capitalism is nonetheless state-centered. Okay, which Hart and Negri actually don't think in their book. Okay, I'm told that Tony Negri is writing a sequel to his book, in which he tries to deal with American empire in a somewhat more concrete way than he actually did in his previous work. The construction, the difference between the previous period and the period we have entered is that the informal American empire from 1945 to 1991, which was based, as I said, on a large degree of institutionalized cooperation, okay? There was a certain amount of violence and coercion in it. There was a great amount of violence in the Third World. But among the core countries, there was a large amount of institutionalized cooperation, and there was a process of institutionalization, which actually, to some degree, constrained the possibilities for unilateralism and unilateral action of the most powerful actor in that system. Okay? What we are seeing today in the erosion, in the breakdown of that system, is the possibility offered for a kind of utopian spread of American power, which has a logic of its own, and it's the same kind of logic which pushed Great Britain in the 19th century to expand in defense of the Indian Empire. And to some extent, the Persian Gulf today has become the Indian Empire problem of the United States, you see. Fear is wonderful, but it only lasts so long. Osama bin Laden was not afraid, you see. You can scare state actors because state actors, we suppose that state actors are rational actors and that they will respond to threats to their own survival through rational decision-making processes, which is, of course, the reason why containment of Saddam Hussein is a much more reasonable alternative than his preventive and preemptive destruction. But you cannot contain non-state transnational actors, nor can you make them fear. In the same way as you can contain the rational state actor. So what I'm saying is that in the process of elaborating an imperial ideology and an imperial practice, which is very much Westphalian in the sense that the United States, these are the people who are doing this in the United States are sovereignists, okay? They believe in the Westphalian state system, you know, nation states and the power of the nation state. They do not believe in transnational cosmopolitical alternatives, all right? They don't read Habermas, and they don't read Ulrich Beck, and they don't care about Habermas and Ulrich Beck, okay? They read Kagan and Kaplan and others, you know, dark, angry, evil realists, you know, who believe that Hobbes is the ultimate answer to reality, okay? That anarchy war plus Darwin makes for a nice little concoction, okay? So in so doing, they are creating the conditions, I think, the conditions for indeed a return to anarchy, a return to anarchy. Now, once anarchy is there, it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy, because that's a strong argument then for an imperial hegemon. and as anarchy spreads, as violence spreads, they have a permanent argument for mobilization. I'll tell you something else, the deepest, darkest secret of the crowd of people who are presently in power in the United States, I'm not talking about George Bush, I'm talking about the neoconservatives around him, is that they're Schmittians. They're followers of Carl Schmitt through Leo Strauss, okay? There's an ideological filiation there which is quite clear, which is quite explicit in the case of many of them. Schmitt's idea of the permanent mobilization of the state to create meaning, Schmitt's notion that you have to permanently define the enemy in a binary system, friend-enemy, okay? Schmitt's dark, dubious, and dangerous notion, okay, that the state reveals its inner true inner meaning only under conditions of war, you see? The neoconservatives presently in power in the United States are not liberals. They believe in the power of the state. They believe, in a certain sense, in a certain form of authoritarian state, coupled to some extent with free markets, but only when that serves the purposes of the strong imperial state and of the state at war. The state at war. Okay, we're dealing with a crowd, which is, as far as I'm concerned, a dangerous crowd. Where does this bring us? To disaster.
Okay, just one more question. I'll take on the theory that we should always look at upstairs because they get left out. I'll take you upstairs. Well, wait, because he's going to bring you a microphone.
You should.
two quick questions. First of all, do you think we can derive laws about the longevity of empires from the relatively small number of empires that have existed in the past? It seems to me that you can't, simply because empires in the past have devoted a lot of the resources to military. It doesn't mean that because it's happening now that the American empire is in the last phase. Another question was, do you think it is better to conduct the analysis and debate more empirically? Because I think people like Ignatieff do it at such an abstract theoretical level that if they were to look at the countless interventions by the states in the last 50 years, that analysis could not be supported, simply that the most interventions by the states do not promote or support human rights or democracy. They do support free trade, but if you look at about 60, 70 cases, the majority don't. So I think it needs more concrete empirical analysis.
Well, I quite agree with that last point. There is a need for empirical analysis. In fact, if I were sitting in front of people at the State Department and arguing against the present policies implemented by the Bush administration, I would do just that. I would point out that the U.S. interventions over the past 30 or 40 years have been generally counterproductive, that they've generally turned out to be disastrous. Vietnam is merely one case among many. And that the United States actually would gain from cooperative, you know, from the construction of cooperative frameworks, and point to Europe, Japan, South Korea, and other places, although South Korea was pretty coercive, as examples of what reasonable hegemonic policy should be. But I'm not sitting in front of the State Department. And I'm not arguing now in front of the State Department. I think that
I think that we face over the next couple of months and hence the next couple of years a situation of deep crisis and profound destabilization of the world system. And that what we are seeing a transformative moment. We're in a transformative moment in which to some extent, rational argument with some of these forces will become extremely difficult. So I think that indeed we should empirically ground this. We should point out, you know, why and how things could be done better. But let me give you an example. There was a choice. There was another choice to be made after 9/11. There was the choice, for example, the U.S. administration could very well have chosen to move forward very forcefully, very energetically on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. That was a possible choice. They could have lessened the level of ideological violence in the region by doing so. They could also have chosen to privilege multilateral cooperation in the struggle against international non-state terrorism, which they did not do. So they chose, they actually made choices, okay? And those choices were not choices which you could, in a certain sense, rationally argue against, in the sense that you could say, well, you know, there are better alternatives. Or they could have chosen to launch a vast Marshall Plan for the region, for Central Asia, for the Middle East, and so on. They could have, in cooperation with Europe and Japan, which would have had very strong, dynamic Keynesian effects on the U.S. economy, and on the world economy as a whole. But that was not the choice they made. And I think it's interesting to try to analyze why they made the choices that they made. Furthermore, those choices, it's interesting to note, those choices have structural effects, long-term structural effects in terms of the organization and shape of the American state, in terms of the power of the military-industrial establishment, in terms of the power of the intelligence services, long-term structural effects, which will be hard to roll back afterwards. Once you launch a vast defense mobilization like they have launched, and which will probably be completed over the next 5 years, it's not possible for the next president or the president after that even to suddenly say we're going to stop the programs. So this has an institutional, a structural institutional effect in power political terms in the United States itself. I think their choices have to be deconstructed in terms of this particular power group's attempt to make to make more permanent their domestic power, as well as the consolidation of U.S. power abroad.
I just have to say that I read the Michael Ignatieff article in a very different way than you have.
Uh-huh.
I read him as saying America's safety does depend on having a genuine, if you like, imperialist role in the sense of doing nation building, doing human rights, doing markets, doing democracy. But the problem with the Bush administration is it's not doing that.
Yes, but yes.
It's actually threatening all that. That was how I read his article.
Yes, it's true. There's also that in his article. It's a critique from the standpoint of soft power. I mean, it's not for nothing that he's with Joe Nye at the Kennedy School of Government. But so yes, it's a critique from the standpoint of soft power on the exclusive reliance of hard power. But what I was trying to say is that the liberal imperialists feel qualms about America's imperial role, and they think it should indeed be, you know, softened by other things. But they all say, and Ignatieff does say it in the article, he basically says the United States really doesn't have any alternative other than to pursue a global ordering agenda through force. But it has to temper that with other things, you see. I much prefer liberal imperialists to the hardcore right-wing imperialists, but they're nonetheless imperialists, you know. Well, Robert Cooper, you know.
Yeah, well, we'll come back on that, but it's not my turn to get engaged in the debate, so I think we should go on and hear Robert on financial. Robert Wade, who's professor here at the London School of Economics, and has our third speaker just arrived. But maybe we'll still go on to Robert and give him a chance to catch his breath. Robert Wade is professor here at the London School of Economics, professor of political economy or development, and he's going to talk to us about financial empires.
Well, actually, I'm going to talk about the second track of the Empire Project. The second track that Philippe did not talk about, which is the economic and financial track. And perhaps I can begin, since Joe Nye has just been referred to, by referring to the argument that he made in this very place just a few weeks ago. You may remember, those of you who were here, that he and his writings are very widely read, making the same argument. You remember that he says that to understand what's happening in the world, you have to think of it as a three-dimensional chess game. That is, with three boards of chess, the game going on simultaneously on each board. At the top board, that's the military board. That's where the kinds of things that Philippe was talking about are going on. And there, yes, the US is clearly unipolar, clearly carrying out a hegemonic project. But at the second chessboard, that's the chessboard of interstate economic relations, there is no hegemonic project. The word doesn't make sense, he said, at that level. There is a balance of power between the US, Europe, Japan, and so on. A kind of liberal balance of power. And then at the third, the bottom chessboard, market relations, transnational market relations between, say, multinational corporations. There, he said, to my astonishment, there is chaos. There's no system of power at that level. And I do find this quite extraordinary that he could picture the world in these terms, and in particular because he misses out things that are happening, especially on the second chessboard, interstate relations, where it seems to me that the US, and this is the parallel with what is happening on the military security track that Philippe was talking about, the US is locking in, with the help, certainly, of Europe and Japan, but very much it's an effort led by the US, is locking in rules of the international economy through organizations like the WTO, the World Bank, the IMF, rules which such that the normal operation of market processes within this framework of rules tends to produce an oligarchic distribution of wealth, that is a redistribution of wealth upwards into the hands of the countries at the top, led by the US. And I want to make this point that this is happening through the, quote, natural processes of markets, without the hegemonic power having to throw its military weight around more than occasionally. I mean, what the US is doing now in the Middle East is very expensive. It exposes the US to all kinds of hassles. Much better for it to be able to rely more upon the natural workings of market processes to generate a flow of world income to the US. And I want to contrast this notion of markets as constructed entities with the view of, which is very common in the economics profession, articulated, for example, by that famous economist, Alan Greenspan, chairman of the US Central Bank. And this is what he said recently, quote, markets are an expression of the deepest truths about human nature, and as a result, they will ultimately be correct. The observation I want to make is that he is talking there of markets as a sort of natural phenomenon that grows out of human nature. And the point I want to make is that markets are constructed phenomena, and how they operate depends upon the rules which are set for the players in markets. And my point is that rules are being set, such as in the WTO today, which have the effect of tipping the world distribution of income even more against developing countries, let us say, than it is at the moment, and in a way which will, as Philippe suggested, will lock in this distribution for decades into the future, because these rules, once put in place, are very difficult to change. So this then is a story about the sinews of the American Empire light, as you called, as people advocating this kind of project have called it. Philippe mentioned that the U.S. was busy destroying UN organizations, and there is an element of truth in that, but there is also another thing, which is that the U.S., assisted by the Europeans and the Japanese, but particularly the U.S., are using international organizations to rewrite the rules of international markets. And this is happening now, particularly in the WTO. We've had these great explosions of protest about the WTO, but what I think is being much less noticed is the day-by-day, month-by-month formation of agreements which, in the aggregate, add up to a very powerful advantage for the firms, the citizens in the already rich part of the world. For example, the TRIMS agreement that came out of the Uruguay round. TRIMS stands for trade-related investment measures. And this is an agreement that's based on the premise that whereas in the past the central norm of the international trading regime was no discrimination, that is, one nation cannot discriminate between suppliers based in different countries. That's the most favored nation principle. Now the norm, the new norm of the international trading regime is, quote, no distortions. So it's moved from no discrimination between suppliers in different countries. You can't give preference to suppliers in this country and not to that country. It's moved from that to a norm of no distortions. That is, countries, Korea, Brazil, are not allowed to adopt internal domestic policies which, quote, distort, unquote, trade. So that's the norm of no distortions. For me, this is particularly significant because I've done a lot of research on East Asian development. What I find extraordinary is that if you look at the TRIMS agreement, Trade-Related Investment Measures Agreement in the WTO, what it does is it is as though it was written with a list of the industrial policies that East Asian countries like Japan, like Korea, like Taiwan, that they used, I think, to good effect in propelling them up the world hierarchy of nations, in bringing them to the point of living standards, which are the same, more or less, as we have here. If you look at the industrial policies that they used, then the TRIMS agreement systematically makes those policies illegal. I'm thinking, for example, of the way in which the TRIMS agreement prevents a government of a developing country, Brazil, Uganda, whatever, prevents them from putting requirements, performance requirements, on subsidiaries of multinational corporations wanting to establish in their country. Vietnam would be another good example. The Vietnamese government, well, wait a minute, no, because Vietnam is not yet a member of the WTO. But any country that is a member of the WTO is not allowed to, for example, require subsidiaries of multinational corporations to buy an increasing proportion of local content in the products that they make. Or the government is not allowed to put a requirement of joint venturing so that the subsidiary has to get a domestic partner, or the government is not allowed under this TRIMS agreement to require a multinational corporation operating in that country to transfer technology. A whole lot of things that the East Asian governments did, I think, to good effect in order to domesticate technology, to get foreign technology from abroad and then to be able to use it to produce competitive products which can challenge industries in the already rich countries. All these policies are basically either already illegal or are being made illegal under the TRIMS agreement. And that is a rather dramatic example, I think, of how the TRIMS agreement is making it more difficult for developing countries to overcome the kind of gravitational forces that keep them down at the bottom of the economic hierarchy. Another example would be the TRIPS agreement, trade-related intellectual property agreement. And according to the TRIPS agreement, developing countries have a greatly shrunk latitude of choice as to, for example, how long the patents that they grant are. They must grant patents for a minimum of 20 years. They must similarly respect copyrights according to the criteria that are already current in the rich countries. If you look at what all the developed countries, the now developed countries, have done, they counterfeited. They did not respect foreign patent rights, and the US most of all did not respect foreign patent rights in the 19th century when it was a developing country. All this is now being prevented, and very tough patent requirements being put upon governments that are members of the WTO. It's interesting that the great thrust of the WTO, the central thrust, is market liberalization on the premise that market access to rich country markets is the key to economic development. So that's the way in which the WTO claims to be a development-oriented organization, by saying that market access is the key to development. But it's interesting that while agreements like the TRIMS agreement, also the GATS agreement, General Agreement on Trade and Services, services for education, for health, for water and sanitation, and so on, while these two agreements, the TRIMS and the GATS, are agreements to liberalize markets, to prevent governments from, for example, adopting development strategies that favor domestic producers, the TRIPS agreement, T-R-I-P-S, as I said, trade-related intellectual property agreements, is an agreement for protection, but protection for the patent holders in the rich countries, or the copyright holders in the rich countries. And so this is a way by which, the TRIPS agreement is a way by which patent holders, copyright holders in the rich countries, especially the US, are locking in flows of royalties for a long time into the future, in a way that their own countries in the course of development certainly did not do. That's a snapshot of what's happening in the WTO. There ought to be much more NGO attention on what is happening in the WTO, getting information about what is happening in these negotiations out to the wider world than there actually is. In terms of the World Bank, just an example from the World Bank, the World Bank is comprehensively redefining its priorities to give priority to what is called the private sector initiative. And this is an initiative to encourage its borrowing countries to open up their markets to private providers of services, such as education services, private, let us say American or British or New Zealand, education firms coming in to provide education in a developing country, or to run the water system, or to provide healthcare services. The bank is very much coordinating with the WTO in pushing this kind of agenda of liberalization in service provision in its borrowing countries. But the thing I want to finish on, and that I think is really as serious as anything I've been talking about, is the push that's been going on for the past 10-15 years to get the whole world to open the capital account. That is, for all governments to remove restrictions on the inflow and outflow of financial capital. All through the Clinton treasury led by Rubin, led by Summers, had a great campaign. This was their top priority in terms of international economic policy, to get all countries to open their capital account so that there would be no restrictions on the ability of American financial firms, Goldman Sachs, for example, to move capital in and out of markets just according to when it wanted to move capital in and out of markets. The Clinton Treasury used not only bilateral agreements, but also used the IMF. This is another example of the U.S. not destroying these organizations, but taking them over to very much advance an agenda which can be linked to this empire project. The U.S. used the IMF to push IMF countries in crisis, or countries very dependent upon the IMF, to open their capital accounts. Even of all countries in the world, the IMF really twisted the arm of the government of Ethiopia, one of the poorest countries in the world, whose total financial system is the size of a small American bank. The IMF even pushed the Ethiopian government to open the capital account and threatened them that if it did not, it would not allow Ethiopia to remain within what it called the Extended Structural Adjustment Program for Africa, which is a special concessional fund lending program for the poorest and crisis-affected African countries. Even though Ethiopia met all the other conditions that the fund was demanding in terms of budget surpluses and all kinds of other things, Ethiopian government drew the line on opening the capital account. And so the fund said, okay, because you don't meet this condition, and we think this condition is very important, you can't stay within this structural adjustment program. And because of this, Ethiopia not only lost access to this very cheap fund lending, but there was cross-conditionality, so that because Ethiopia was not under this fund program, it was also excluded from concessional lending from the World Bank, from the Paris Club, and from a whole lot of bilateral aid agencies. There was cross-conditionality. The fund was the gatekeeper. Interestingly enough, it was Joe Stiglitz who spoke from this podium a year or so ago in the Miliband lecture. It was Joe Stiglitz who was flown secretly into Addis Ababa when he was vice president for the World Bank to advise the Ethiopian government on how to resist the fund's demand that the Ethiopia opened its capital account. And that was the beginning of Stiglitz's falling out with the president of the World Bank, with the U.S. Treasury, and so on and so on, and led to his from the World Bank. That was the beginning of that story. Then there was a kind of, after the Asian crisis, there was a kind of hiatus, and these organizations, the Treasury, the IMF, the World Bank, and so on, backed off their push for all countries to open the capital account, because opening the capital account in East Asia was so clearly implicated in the Asian crisis, that already by 1999, only 2 years after the crisis, Kam Dasoo, still the managing director of the bank, was saying, now is the time to reestablish momentum for worldwide opening of the capital accounts. And the reason why I think this is so particularly important and so important to resist is because what is happening now, and I expect that we will soon, even though this Bush government doesn't seem to be nearly as close to Wall Street as I had expected, and that may mean that the US Treasury will not be as active in pushing for this opening as the Clinton Treasury was, but I do expect that this push for opening the capital account will be restarted fairly soon. And it represents a quite extraordinary case, not of not learning, but of unlearning. I say unlearning because all through the 1920s, up to and including the World Economic Conference of 1933, the US and the UK led the effort to get all countries to have open capital accounts, free movement of capital, as well as recommit to the gold standard and have independent central banks. Those were at least three of the four key items that were being pushed by the US and the UK, partly through the League of Nations, during this time, the 1920s, and the 1930s, and quite a lot of action took place. Countries did open the capital accounts. And even in the World Economic Conference of 1933, when the Depression was at its height, the demand was still, we must open the capital accounts. And then came the Bretton Woods negotiations, 1944, and Keynes went to those negotiations determined to get a commitment from the Allied powers that in the post-war economic architecture, countries should have the option of not opening the capital account. It should be within the powers of national governments to decide whether to open a capital account and how to do it, how much to do it. And when he came back from the Bretton Woods negotiations, he identified this, the commitment to allow countries to have the option of opening or closing the capital account. He regarded this as the most important result from the Bretton Woods conference. As he said, what used to be heterodox has now become orthodox. That is the acceptance of closed capital accounts. Well, we learned that lesson. Most countries had closed capital accounts till at least the early 1980s. The Bretton Woods period, looking back on it, was quite a successful period in terms of world economic history. And now, even though we've had this series of financial crises, increasing financial crises, since the 1980s, since countries began to open their capital accounts, and most spectacularly the Asian crisis, we are still in a situation where dominant economic thinking, led by U.S. economists, led U.S. policymakers, thinks that it is very important for the world to open the capital accounts. The people who benefit from that are, of course, the people in the existing financial centers. But I think it's very bad for the rest of the world. But if you were a modern-day Roman emperor, and I finish on this note, if you were a modern-day Roman emperor in a world of sovereign states, and you wanted to configure the whole world so that the natural workings of market processes within the framework that you construct rebounded to the benefit of your citizens, then one of the most important things you would do is to have open capital accounts. But it may be very bad for the rest of the world.
Now, the theory was that we allowed two questions before going on to the next speakers. But last time, the two questions were very long, and so were the answers.
So why don't you go straight on?
Well, I'm ready to ask two questions, provided people really ask questions and don't give speeches and you give quick answers.
Okay.
So why don't we have two quick questions? The lady in the back. And actually, I'll ask them both at once, because that will speed things up.
Okay. My question has to do with trade liberalization and what do you think the impact of trade liberalization is, not just on benefiting, let's say, the U.S. or even Europe, but also on democratization? Because, for instance, in the free trade area of the Americas, one of the underlying reasons behind liberalizing trade in that area is because it's between democratic countries to support democracy and so on. Do you think that there's a role for that in empire, if it is empire?
Okay, and one more question. I'll take this gentleman here.
My question is very simple. What do you think of the evolution of the general spirit and attitude of the Department of Economics here at the LSE regarding these these orthodoxies and heterodoxies, etc.?
Robert.
What do I think about the thinking of the LSE Economics Department? Well, the LSE Economics Department is ranked very high in the world, and from that you know immediately that it is a very orthodox department. It is operating within quite narrow parameters. There's very little study of development economics, very little study of what you could call institutional economics. It's using a particular kind of epistemology. And I admire a lot of the work that's done. I just wish that there was a bit more of a commitment to the principle of intellectual diversity, as in the analogy with biodiversity, the principle that an ecology is healthy when there is a considerable biodiversity. I think the same applies intellectually, but it happens in economics more than in any other social science, there is a single criterion of ranking, then that in itself narrows the range of intellectual views that are welcomed into the department. I have to say on trade liberalization and democracy, I didn't really get the question, and maybe we should just hold it off till our third speaker has spoken.
All right. So now I'm very happy that Serge Halimi has arrived, another editor of Le Monde Diplomatique, and he's going to talk to us about media empires.
Yes, I'm going to talk about the ideological transmission belt of the empire, if you will. These days, one thing seems to surprise us, and it is the lack of independence of the fabled fourth estate. Even the French very right-wing TV network, TF1, not known for its independence, had its news director state last week, I quote, "Today, those famous US networks we heard so much about as examples of professional integrity are acting like propaganda tools for the Bush administration. They have lost all critical distance from that crisis," meaning Iraq. Maybe it is time to see what happened to the US media. It also happened elsewhere, and it didn't start with George W. Bush. Let me begin with a quote. "One of our best kept secrets is the degree to which a handful of huge corporations control the flow of information in the United States, whether it is television, radio, newspapers, magazines, books, or the internet. A few giant conglomerates are determining what we see, hear, and read, and the situation is likely to become much worse," end quote. You may dismiss what I just read to you. After all, the quote is from Bernie Sanders, one of the most progressive members of the US House of Representatives. But Bernie Sanders does not exaggerate. In 1983, the US had roughly 1,700 daily newspapers, 11,000 magazines, 9,000 radio, 1,000 television stations, 2,500 book publishers. At that time, however, merely 50 multinationals, all interlocked in common financial interests with other massive industries and with a few dominant international banks, controlled the majority of the big outlets. Clearly something had to be done, and so it was, but not what you would logically expect. In 1996, the US Congress, which had just cut federal aid to the poor, granted frequencies worth $70 billion at that time, a lot more now, at no cost to the recipients. Viacom, Disney, and General Electric, the respective owners of CBS, ABC, and NBC networks, were the main beneficiaries of the decision. Protesting this giveaway, Senator John McCain, a Republican, made the following statement during the congressional debate. "There will be hardly any talk of this decision on radio or TV, because the radio and TV networks are the ones directly affected." As a matter of fact, during the 9 months that elapsed between the introduction of the legislation and its final approval, the three main news networks devoted a mere 19 minutes to the subject. The question of whether the largest communication companies could afford to pay for the frequencies that the US government had awarded them was not raised a single time. Since the 1980s, control of the media has grown ever more concentrated. This year, 10 giant corporations reign over the information age. Back in 1996, not long ago, the two largest radio chains owned 115 stations. Today, these two own more than 1,400. The number of station owners in the meantime has dwindled by a third. Clearly, something has to be done, and so it will be. But again, not what you would logically expect. According to the Federal Communications Commission, FCC, which largely determines US media policy, the trouble is that large conglomerates are too restricted by legal limits on market share. The solution then is sweeping deregulation of the field. A US federal court has ordered the FCC to reconsider its rule preventing broadcasters from reaching more than 35% of households in the United States. And since everyone knows that FCC Chairman Michael Powell, appointed by President Bush, and the son of Secretary of State Colin Powell, is no fan of such limits, the court order is seen as an invitation for the big broadcasters to swallow smaller ones. The FCC is reconsidering many of the rules that have preserved some media diversity in the United States. Michael Powell keeps repeating, "The market is my religion." Moreover, the lack of political diversity hardly bothers him. I quote, "I'm not so sure that Disney and Murdoch's personal political interests are ever permitted by the board of directors or Wall Street to trump anything that would maximize value," end quote. The fact that maximizing value may amount to an ideological slant of sorts hardly seems to have crossed Michael Powell's mind. And what do media conglomerates say on the matter? Companies such as News Corporation and Viacom are protesting that existing regulations deprive them of their First Amendment right to free speech. The rollback of some of the last regulatory checks on media consolidation appears very likely, therefore. Like, for instance, the regulation preventing the owners of a broadcast station from buying a newspaper in the same city and vice versa, or from owning more than one TV station in the same market. This newspaper broadcast cross-ownership ban guarantees that communities will not find their only local daily paper to have been bought by one of the TV networks, a further drop in news quality and original content if newspapers would be likely where those papers absorbed by the broadcast TV industry. Another likely rollback relates to the regulation preventing one company from owning broadcast stations that reach more than 35% of US households, or the regulation barring major TV networks, ABC, CBS, Fox, NBC, from just merging with one another. As we speak, mergers and cooperation between former competitors multiply. The Washington Post, which lost regular foreign distribution of its stories because of the New York Times forced buyout of the Post's stake in the International Herald Tribune, will have its stories appear in the European and Asian edition of the Wall Street Journal. The Post has similar arrangements with NBC. These days, it is difficult to ascertain which outlet, the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post, or NBC, is the most hawkish. You want diversity? Go online. The FCC argues that technologies like the Internet offer Americans access to more information than ever, and thus worries about monopolies are unfounded. But studies also show that most Americans receive their news from a handful of outlets. Beyond this, much of what appears on the Internet is repackaged from those outlets. The leading 20 Internet sites and biggest cable channels are owned by GENBC, Disney, Fox, Gannett, AOL, Time Warner, Hearst, Microsoft, Cox, Dow Jones, The Washington Post, and The New York Times. In 1999, not so long ago, 110 companies attracted 60% of the time web users spent online. By 2001, 2 years later, 14 companies only had taken the same share. The question of concentration is most acute at the local level. In most communities, even those with television and radio stations, the vast range of activities are covered by only one institution, the local newspaper. State communism may be dead in the world. Corporate communism is flourishing in the United States. Companies that own multiple platforms, print, television, radio, and internet in the same city, are integrating their news production process using do-it-all journalists to create content for many media at once. The new work regime often undermines a paper's capacity to meet its own standards. As Columbia journalism professor John Pavlik reports, people are putting in 16 to 20 hour days and getting burned out as they perform several jobs at once. Again, because of meager press coverage, most people have no idea what is taking place. But what are the consequences of this? Let me quote again, but this time from a Republican columnist, William Safire. He does not write for Le Monde Diplomatique. He was a strong pro-Reagan type and is now very much pro-Bush, except on question of civil liberties. Safire wrote, "You won't find television magazine programs fearlessly exposing the broadcast lobby's pressure on Congress and the courts to allow station owners to gobble up more stations and cross-own local newspapers, thereby to determine what information residents of a local market receive. Nor will you find many newspaper chains assigning reporters to reveal the effect of media gigantism on local coverage or cover the way publishers induce coverage-hungry politicians to loosen antitrust restraints." End quote. He's right, it is unlikely you will find this. We seem to know better where increased competition, or so we were told, led the American public. Truly independent coverage of big media is disappearing. Television is the means by which most Americans get their news. Well, without exception, every major network is owned by a huge conglomerate that has enormous conflicts of interest. Fox News Channel is owned by Rupert Murdoch, a right-wing Australian, whom you know very well here, who already owns a significant portion of the world's media. His network has close ties to the Republican Party, and among his fair and balanced commentators is Newt Gingrich, former Republican Speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives and current war hawk regarding Iraq. NBC. NBC is owned by General Electric, one of the largest corporations in the world, and one with a long history of anti-union activity. GE is a major contributor to the Republican Party. It has substantial financial interest in weapons manufacturing, finance, nuclear power, and many other industries. Former CEO Jack Welch was one of the leaders in shutting down American plants and moving them to low-wage countries like China and Mexico. NBC is also the company which gave Ronald Reagan a job of corporate booster for many, many years, of which he acquitted himself quite well. ABC is owned by the Disney Corporation, which produces toys and products in developing countries, where they provide their workers atrocious wages and working conditions. CBS is owned by Viacom and other huge media conglomerate that owns, among other entities, MTV, Showtime, 39 broadcast television stations, 184 radio stations, Paramount Pictures, and Blockbuster Inc. A danger of concentrated ownership is that news organizations embedded in large conglomerates will promote their own products or fail to critically investigate their vested interests. Communication scholars have already discovered emerging evidence of what they call a synergy bias inside conglomerates. Moreover, now that most American news companies are governed by MBAs, responsibilities to shareholders and concern about stock values are driving the reorganization of media enterprises, often despite the protests of editors and producers. When news becomes just another commodity, the distinction between journalistic products, information, entertainment, infotainment, etc., lose their significance, as do substantive reports. A well-publicized synergy collision happened in 1997 at CBS News when reporters were spotted wearing the Nike swoosh at the Olympics, the unfortunate outgrowth of a lucrative financial deal between CBS Sports and Nike. At about the same time, a CBS investigator was facing delay in an article on Nike's labor practices. With consolidation, the balance of power is firmly in the hands of a small number of companies with interest and investments spread across the media landscape. A small number of companies more interested in delivering viewers to advertisers than in serving the needs of the public. Likewise, foreign policy coverage has been taking a hit for the last 15 years. Before September 11, the Boston Globe explained, I quote, "International news coverage in most of America's 1,500 mainstream papers has almost reached the vanishing point. Foreign stories that accounted for about 10% of the average newspaper's news content in 1972 have shrunk to less than 2%. News magazines have followed the downward trend. In the 10 years from 1985 to 1995, Time, Newsweek, and US News and World Report cut their foreign reporting from about 22% of the magazine to about 12%. Asked why, editors explained that foreign news is less urgent, that was the answer of Time, less relevant, that was the answer of US News, and mean a 25% drop in newsstand sales, that was the answer of Newsweek. The same trend is at work in network television news. 10 years ago, 40% of the three networks' news programs were devoted to foreign news. The figure has slipped below 12%. According to a poll made public by Fox News 3 years ago, 40%, 3 years ago, 40% of Americans said they were not sure whether the US or Slobodan Milosevic had won the war in Kosovo. And that was in 2000, the year after the war had taken place. 9/11 and the war in Afghanistan and Iraq have barely changed things in this matter. Foreign policy coverage remains marginal, according to the last study published by the Columbia Journalism Review, trailing far behind local crime stories, sports, and celebrity news. And things are hardly better on the home front. The US has just undergone some of the biggest business scandals in its history, in part because of the extreme lack of curiosity of most journalists. 2 years ago, CEO Gerald Levin was on the cover of Fortune, which he owned at the time. He was praised as among the smartest people we know. 10 weeks later, the merger he had engineered was a disaster error. It is true that some star journalists who were financially profiting from the stock market bubble had very little reason to challenge its long-term viability. Moreover, luminaries of the profession have lined their pockets with corporate honoraria. David Brinkley, Robert Novak, David Gergen, Cokie Roberts, Christopher Matthews, Larry King, Mark Shields, Fred Barnes, George Will, and Michael Kinsley, the last one who memorably said, "I didn't do it for years, but it became more socially acceptable." As one revolutionary fast company after the next crashes amidst reports of greed, deception, and illegal accounting, and workers watch their retirement funds dwindle, Americans have reasons to wonder about the type of reporting they got from big media on these matters. Radio stations sound no different, playing the same program and using the same formats throughout the vast country. to such a point that sociologist Eric Kleinenberg notes ironically, I quote, "At the moment that Americans are learning to embrace multiculturalism, a monoculture of mainstream material is taking over the airwaves." Actually, it's even worse than that. Corporate radio is just plain overt in its right-wing bias. There are dozens of right-wing talk show programs. Rush Limbaugh, Gordon Liddy, Bob Grant, Michael Savage, Michael Reagan, Pat Robertson, to name only a few of the voices that pound a right-wing drumbeat in the United States. Since its launch in 1996, Fox has become a central hub of the conservative movement's well-oiled media machine. Together with the Republican Party and its satellite think tanks and advocacy groups, this network of fiercely partisan outlets, such as the Washington Times, the Wall Street Journal editorial page, and conservative talk radio shows, forms an effective right-wing echo chamber where Republican-friendly news stories can be promoted, repeated, and amplified. Fox knows how to play this game better than anyone. Despite the great economic boom of the 1990s, the average American worker is now working longer hours for lower wages than 30 years ago. This subject is rarely the staple of television investigations. The United States has the most unfair distribution of wealth and income in the industrialized world, but few programs belabor the fact that the richest 1% own more wealth than the bottom 95%, or that CEOs of major corporations earn 691 times what their employees make. It was 41 times that much in 1980. We now know that major US newspapers do not only participate in the promotion of wealth, they also beat the drum of war with great effectiveness and become a leading player in the diplomatic game. The point was driven home to us very recently when Thursday before last, a story led the Wall Street Journal's front page. I have it here. 8 European leaders sign letter backing US. The reporter from the Wall Street Journal London Bureau reported in a broad statement supporting the US in its effort to strip Iraq of weapons of mass destruction, 8 European leaders signed an op-ed article publicly calling for unity with the US position, further shifting the global political calculus toward support for war. The question here is that most op-ed page articles are solicited by the section's editors, and that was the case with the journal statement by the European leaders. In other words, as the Los Angeles Times noted, the paper had orchestrated a declaration of support for a Bush administration policy, which its own editorial page has unstintingly supported, and then reported that event as news. According to the Wall Street Journal editor Paul Gigot, the very unusual op-ed piece originated with an idea by Mike Gonzalez, the deputy editorial editor of the journal's European edition. I quote, "After the flap about France and Germany opposing the US on Iraq," Gigot said, "Mike acted as a journalist and called the offices of two other heads of state, Silvio Berlusconi and José María Aznar, offering them the opportunity to do separate pieces on their position. Aznar's office apparently got the idea that they should see if they could get other prime ministers and heads of state on board. They took it from there and got Tony Blair involved, and it all snowballed. At that point, our only concern was to make sure it ran in our paper." In an editorial, the Op-Ed Alliance, the Wall Street Journal hardly pretended to journalistic objectivity, and it proudly acknowledged the political pro-war role it had played in the matter. Our sin seems to be that we assisted in exposing as fraudulent the conventional wisdom that France and Germany speak for all of Europe, and that all of Europe is now anti-American. We've been in favor of ousting Saddam Hussein for years, going back to the Gulf War, and long before President Bush made it his policy. If the op-ed by Europe's leaders somehow helped Mr. Bush's diplomacy in addition to selling newspapers, that's fine with us. End quote. In the same issue, the man behind the scoop, Michael Gonzalez, recounts how it happened. Let's be done with that right away. The Journal is an independent newspaper and doesn't carry water for any government. So here's what happened. About 2 weeks ago, I placed a call to a source in the Italian government. I asked right away, so are you going to let the French and the Germans speak for all of Europe? Why doesn't Silvio Berlusconi write us a piece with his views? At first, the response was tepid. But then, as Gonzalez explains, I was at a museum trying to ease my disappointment with a dose of Bruegel and Rubens when my wife's cell phone rang. And this time the response was favorable. Blair, Aznar, and Berlusconi thus replaced Rubens and Bruegel. Yes. It seems to me two things stand out of this story, which I think is quite significant. First, the link between economic policy and diplomacy in the Middle East. It is probably because of the editorial support the Wall Street Journal has lent to the economic policies of Berlusconi, Aznar, and Blair that the paper has gained the extraordinary leverage enabling it to call these European leaders and directly advise policy on these matters and on the matter of war in Iraq. I can hardly imagine any other paper in the world, save maybe for the Financial Times, directly lobby for policies at that high a level, and that successfully. The second thing is this. If you want to know the plight of the American press today, just imagine what its reaction would be now if a left-wing paper had directly lobbied foreign heads of state toward making a statement opposing US policy in the Gulf. Propaganda tools for the US administration does not seem so harsh a conclusion from what we see and read coming from the United States these days. Thank you.
Well, that's a very grim story we've just been told.
It is.
I would suggest I'm going to take two questions like I did before. We've really only got 15 minutes left. So I'll take two questions directly to Serge, and then if we have time, I'll take one more. Then on my principle of looking upstairs, I have two principles, upstairs and women, but I can't see any women, so upstairs comes first. Oh, she wants to follow up here.
So just a very quick one. In terms of Serge's analysis, does the recent humongous loss, I think it was of Time Warner Company, have any add anything to your analysis?
I didn't hear it actually.
Can't hear.
There was the major loss of the
AOL Time Warner.
Yes.
How does that change the media situation? Let me take one more before you answer.
It doesn't.
Another one to Serge? Yeah.
Since the title or theme of tonight is imperialism in the 21st century, I find myself in a slightly awkward position because I would hate to be an apologist for America given its current policies. However, I wonder whether we are being entirely fair in focusing all our attention simply on America against the world in its imperialism and not looking at the extent to which America may be the writing writ large about what is happening in the rest of the world not least in perhaps each of us in our social relations. We live in a more violent and a more me too, me first world than perhaps has been common in the earlier parts, in the latter parts of the last century. And I also am concerned at the dichotomy of America against the world in the sense that, for example, I've spent a lot of time talking to small and medium-sized American farmers. And they tell me that they are suffering terribly because the internal policies of America, the internal subsidies, are hitting the small men, the small women, driving them out. And I would like you to comment on how we can get a balanced and whole perspective, using America perhaps as an example, but not limiting our perspective to simply demonizing it as the sole offender here.
Okay, well look, I think what I will do, because that was a general question, is perhaps take two or three more questions and then allow each of the speakers to respond. So the lady here.
This is general, it's not specifically media, is that okay? Is it on? I'm interested in contrasting and also looking at the relationship between the militaristic imperialism that you've been talking about and the corporate imperialism that Robert Wright-Wade was talking about. One indeed seems to be extremely nationalistic. It seems very important to the militaristic imperialism, where that doesn't seem true at all of the corporatization, where borders do not seem important. And when I've had the dubious pleasure of being with the business advisors to governments, it's obvious that their connections and their allegiances are very much cross-border, often transatlantic, for instance. The relationship between them seems to me, and very much at this point in time, that one is very much a smokescreen for the other, in a very dangerous sense. For instance, the militarism that we're looking at is obscuring the corporatization to a large extent. For instance, at this point, particular point in time when we should really be screaming about the state of play of the General Agreement on Trade in Services, where in just 6 weeks' time the EU is going to commit our services for liberalisation without even telling national parliaments or members of the European parliaments what they're going to be liberalising. Instead of screaming about the GATS as we should be, we're out there shouting no war. So it's very effectively covering it up in that sense. I wonder how deliberate you feel that is, and I guess the media is complicit in this.
Okay, I think as our numbers are dwindling, I'm going to ask the three speakers to respond to those questions. And I'll start with Serge, because he was the last to speak.
Well, I guess the answer is fairly easy. When it comes to corporate media, I gladly acknowledge, or not gladly, but I acknowledge that America is not so different from other countries. The increasingly corporate trend of the media is something you can witness elsewhere. I mentioned the big companies in the U.S., but if you were looking at France, the names would be different, but the story fairly similar. You would have Bouygues, you would have Hachette, you would have Vivendi, you would have Dassault. And among the four names I've cited, you have Hachette and Dassault, which are weapons suppliers for the army, in the same fashion as General Electric, which owns NBC, supplies weapons to the U.S. Army. Since the subject tonight was the United States, I emphasize the case of the United States. But again, I'm afraid that the United States, as often, is only leading the way.
I think, actually, there's a fascinating linkage now between media empires and weapons empires. And this idea of media and movie people have been advising Bush on war games, how to imagine. And I think that aspect maybe hasn't come up enough. The extent to which the American empire actually is more to do with the Americans' own imaginings than what's happening in the rest of the world. Robert?
Well, just two quick things. On intentionality, to what extent is all this intentional? I'm quite sure that it is less intentional, less guided by some central intelligence than I perhaps implied. But it's very difficult to know. What you can do is to show the congruence of interests, results, and behavior, policies. There is a congruence, and you can infer that in some way that may be difficult to actually pin down, there is some coordination of strategy going on here that is producing this this remarkable similarity across various fronts, the media, the military, what's the US position in the WTO, and so on. But what is the nature of that link, to what extent it's simply a kind of congruence at the level of ideology amongst the people in power, or to what extent it's more sort of active than that, I don't know. But, and just one final point on demonizing America. I worry that commonly the kinds of arguments that I and others have made might be dismissed on the grounds that they are anti-American or that we are demonizing America. I don't myself regard myself as anti-American. If you take the existing unipolar structure of the world as given and ask which other power, if you simply took America out and slotted in some other power, would any of the plausible candidates to be slotted in and to take the dominant role in this unipolar structure, would they be any better than America? That's an open question. I'm not sure that you can point to a country that would be better than America operating in this extraordinarily unipolar structure. So I don't regard what I'm saying by identifying the key role of the US in pushing through these agreements in the WTO, for example, or in pushing, encouraging the World Bank to undertake this private sector initiative, or in mobilizing a campaign in various fora to open capital accounts worldwide. I don't regard that as demonizing America. I think that this is happening, and I think I can explain broadly why it's happening, but it's not demonizing.
Okay, and the final word to Philip.
All right, first of all, very quickly, I think on the point that Robert Wade just made, that it would be hard to find a power today that if you replaced the United States with that power would necessarily have better policies, I would agree with him. I'm not demonizing the United States. I'm not a self-hating American, nor a self-hating Jew, for that matter. I'm a critic of American foreign policy, which is something quite different. So, or to say it in French, I'm criticizing not l'être, but the faire, okay? Not being, but the doing, all right? I think it's fair to be able to do that. On the other point which was raised, I think is a significant point. If you look at the end of the 19th century, at the convergence of the policies of the British imperial state and of the what was emerging at that time as the transnational capitalist caste, banking caste in Great Britain, you find an extraordinary convergence, which was highlighted by Herbert Fies, an extraordinary convergence or congruence of interests, which was mediated through the Bank of England at the time. He shows how it was mediated through the Bank of England. There was a kind of a supple interrelationship among the British elites towards the end of the 19th century. Likewise, today you'll find in the United States a certain kind of congruence of interest between the transnational capitalist caste in the United States and the state. But I would caution, and in one last concluding remark, I think we are seeing at the present time a growing contradiction between, on the one hand, the demands and needs for transnationality of the major economic actors, and on the other hand, the security demands of the national security state.
Just one point. Many of the criticisms we've raised tonight are also made in the United States.
Of course.
I don't see what this accusation of being anti-American means. When I criticize the Chirac economic policies, nobody thinks that I'm anti-French. And so those positions you can find in the United States. You can also read them in the English edition of Le Monde Diplomatique, which is now directly available on subscription.
There's one question. I don't know if you want to go on. But.
I think actually everybody's walking out. I think you should.
Well, not everybody. That is the role of the local elite. Yes, that's true.
Yeah.
That's,
well, I agree.
That's true.
Mr. Lagos in Chile was in the front page last year, being hailed by the American establishment as the most prominent and the most successful president of Latin America. In my way back from Chile last December, I was coming with American Airlines, and happened that next to me, sitting was no more, no less, that the advisor to the legal department of the Treasury on the negotiations between the United States and Chile to incorporate Chile as the first bilateral agreement on the new overall trade agreement for Latin America. What I'm trying to say is that it's not just United States, and it's not just France, and it's not just this country, and it's not just Germany, but the role of the local elites in third world countries to become involved in this process is very, very important. And I think in most of these analyses that I hear today, you are missing a very significant aspect in the way in which the master of the universe, as I call them, and it's just not United States, but this country, the economic policy of this country, the economic policies of Germany, the economic policies of France, of Italy, and so forth and so on, I could go along and along, is not substantially different from what the local elites are doing to our own people.
Okay, well, thank you. And I'm not even going to let our speakers, because it's exactly 8:30. And we're all, everybody's quite tired.
And thank you, Mary Calder.
Thank you.